Hi, I'm Bob Acton, the host of the Color and Ceramics podcast. I'm really excited today to share with you a great conversation I had with Jess and Rob Sutherland. They are the founders of Good Dirt Studio in Athens, Georgia, a dynamic ceramic space dedicated to creativity, community, and clay. As artists and educators, Jess and Rob have cultivated a welcoming environment where students of all levels can explore the joy of working with their hands. Through the thoughtful teaching and community-focused approach, they've built more than just a studio. They've created a space for connection, curiosity, and artistic growth. Today on the Color and Ceramics podcast, we talk about their journey, their philosophy on teaching, and how they're shaping the clay community in Athens and beyond.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Rob and Jess, I am excited about having you guys on board with the Color and Ceramics podcast here today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Most welcome. I really love your work, and I think that's probably what I was attracted to first was your work, because I tried to do a lot of work, my sculpture work, really around animals, and I'm concerned about sort of the loss of biodiversity these days and how we really need to pay attention to that for the health of our planet and so on. So, of course, a lot of your motifs are around insects and flowers and flora and fauna, and so I was certainly keen and attracted to that. So I'd love to chat about some of those ideas, but I wondered if you guys could touch a little bit on your journey and kind of what got you here, so that our audience gets a sense of who you are. But while you're doing that, I would like you to talk a little bit about working together as a couple, because I don't think that's common. I mean, it is. I've seen it out there. But for the most part, I think often ceramicists are kind of working all by themselves, you know, with their head over the wheel or something, right? So if you could touch on that too, that would be awesome.
Well, definitely. You know, we've been together for a little over 10 years, and my mode of operation was always the head down over the potter's wheel. And, you know, wood firing a little bit when I was starting out, participated in other people's wood firings and enjoyed that aspect of community. But surprisingly, for somebody who runs a community studio, when I want to make work, I want to be left alone, be in my little space where I'm controlling all of the variables. I can control what's on the radio and get in my own kind of creative groove. And so for me, it's been a big adjustment to figure out how to work with Jess. She's incredibly talented with the 2D aspect of surface decoration and sculptural additions and concepts and ideas. And I've really had to stretch to find out how I can kind of balance my need for just putting my head down and focusing with the give and take of working in a collaboration. And we're not there yet. I'm not a very good collaborator. I'm not a very good partner as an artist, but I'm hoping to get better. And I see the value in it. I think the work that we make together is better than the sum of its parts. So, you know, it's an ongoing project to figure out how we can best make space for each other's needs in that department. Jess likes to work in series and likes to have a lot of things prepared at once. And I always feel like I don't want to make more work until I see that the previous work is kind of moving through the cycle. I don't like it when tons of bisque ware builds up. It sort of stresses me out, and it may just be working in a small space. I need to see things moving through to get a feeling of like, okay, let's do some more. Let's make some. But I don't know. You want to talk a little bit to that? You can throw me under the bus. I mean, I'm often really hard to deal with. when it comes to that. But she's super, super supportive and encouraging of me just trying to be creative and find forms that excite me. And then she can figure out how to make her surfaces really interact with the form and highlight the things that I'm trying to do. And it's not just slap a flower on a pot. It's very much a, you know, how can each part make the other part more interesting and better? But
So in classic partner dynamic, I'm going to disagree with him. He is a fabulous collaborator, and we are so different in everything, in temperament and how we approach work and how we like to work, but I don't view that as a bad thing. I actually think that those tensions create an opportunity for us to both challenge ourselves more than we ever would have without the other person. And I came to ceramics through Rob and through his work, and actually holding one of his pieces is one of the ways that I fell in love with him. It was such an intimate thing to think, I am feeling where his hands are. I am feeling this moment of time that he created. And from that, I realized that even when we're creating by ourselves, we are not in isolation, right? We are always responding in a way. There's always a conversation. We are always carrying the moments that happened earlier in that day. We are like links in a chain from people that we've interacted with and that we've learned from. So we're all collaborating, whether we realize it or not. And it's been such a fabulous opportunity for me to, I mean, I will give a deluge of ideas and just throw them, throw them, throw them, throw them. And this poor thing is like, well, let me do my thing. And then when he hands it off, I can do mine. And we do them in tandem with one another, but I view it more like a dance. I get to see the first part of the conversation, what he's given me, what he's asked me, and then I put my own layer on it. And I think it's quite a beautiful thing, because we're so different. And one of the things I love most are highlighting those opposites in the surface, and even in the form versus the type of surface. I never would have been able to do that on my own. When I first started, I tried and we got married, and I'm like, well, why am I making the form? I'll catch up with you in 20 years, or you could do them now. And I just think there's this wonderful interplay, there's this wonderful tension, if we want to use an arty word, where he creates these strong masculine forms that are his point of view, and I overlay them with something that perhaps would be considered traditionally feminine, but they work together in a way that they never would have separately because they are a collaboration of voices and there's room for both. And I love that so much. And we also teach together. We run a teaching studio, so he can't escape me. It's been a wonderful opportunity for us to figure out how to communicate. How do you make room for everyone? And I think that negotiation has led us to something, like Rob said, that's greater than it ever could have been on its own. And it's hard. It's very hard, but it's also worth the effort.
Wow. That's very beautiful. I'm struck by your comment about how when you touched his p the piece he made, that you then touched him, and that out of that notion flowed this work that you do together as a couple. It's not his work finished by you. It's a together unit, right? That's a beautiful thing. Wow, that's great.
I think often we have to struggle with the opposite feeling that, you know, if you think about like Picasso's work in ceramics, you don't know the name of the maker of the pot. You think about the decoration. So there's also that sort of interaction where, you know, does Jess's incredible surface decoration sort of erase the functional pot underneath? And I think no, but I've struggled with that occasionally. That's like, you know, are my forms good enough on their own just to stand, or do they need that extra layer to be worthy of, you know, somebody like you asking us to be on a podcast? So that's also been kind of an interesting dynamic.
It's funny how we question those things in ourselves, right?
Yeah, for sure.
We'll talk a bit about that, more of that later, but I do think that that's very interesting, because when I've talked with people on this podcast, I think one of the things that we always talk about is how the surface design and the color match the form. Like, they have to go together. It's not that you can have one without the other. Well, I guess you can. I guess you can have form with not much on the surface, but there's always something on the surface, you know? And so that's very interesting how it's really you two together making this particular unique pot.
Absolutely. And if he hadn't started the conversation, I never would have put that imagery into the world. Like, it is a response. It's not something that overtakes what he's saying. It's more like in dance where you're following your partner. He's giving me the lead and I'm taking it and doing something with it. So for me, it's integral. He's the foundation to everything that happens next.
Well, then we're crazy, and we take these things that she's put hours and hours and hours of work in, and we throw them in a bucket and see what happens. So there's definitely a large degree of masochism involved, because the losses are real. You know, we've got around our house, we've got all the ones that have got the
Side, yeah.
crack up the side, but the surface decoration is beautiful. You can't just throw it in the waster pile, but
Yeah, it is true. I think ceramics has afforded me the opportunity to learn patience, because, like, I don't know of any other art form that has so much breakage or so many opportunities along the path to screw up, right? And
We have a name for that in our studio. We refer to, like, the things when you're learning the wheel, the pieces that don't make it off the wheel and end up in a pile. We call it the pile of learning. And I think we have a very large pile of learning at our house.
Very cool. So, but you guys do some unique stuff. We'll talk about your work in a sec, because I think that's really interesting. But the two of you, you work together, you talk about design and work and how the piece is going to emerge. You teach together, you live together, you're pet owners together. Do you have kids? Not that yet.
No,
So,
not
and
together. I
so,
have kids.
so, like, what do you think the secret has been to your success at being able to pull that together? Because I think that's pretty unique.
I think we're kindred spirits in a lot of ways, and I think we respect each other. We respect each other's intelligence, and I think we're pretty well matched. And also complementary. I mean, there are things that she does really, really well that I'm not as strong in, and vice versa. When the kiln breaks down and needs rewired, that's my job. And when people at the studio need nurturing, hand holding, and or if something needs organized, like a community event, she's all over it and does a beautiful job. She does all of our photography and all of our marketing and all of the sort of maybe more creative aspects of it. I think it's interesting because my background is in science, hard science, and hers is more in humanities and arts. And we're both really good in our academic fields. Neither one of us ended up using our degrees for anything other than just personal enrichment. But I think it does. It kind of informs our temperament and our parts of the collaboration. So.
Well, I think, yeah, you really hit the nail on the head, but because I'm a talker, I'll just expand on that a little bit. It's, am I listening or am I just waiting for my turn to speak? Am I willing and open to learn, or do I assume I know the best way? It is an openness, and that openness is only possible when you can be vulnerable, and that vulnerability is only possible when you trust. And so I think it requires a lot of courage, a lot of hopefulness, and a lot of willingness to change. And maybe the hardest thing of all, say, well, I might be wrong. And boy, is that hard. That's really actually quite hard. But if you are open to that, if you are open to that growth and you grow together, you get stronger and stronger, and it gets easier and easier.
It's learning, isn't it? I mean, you've used the word growth a number of times.
Absolutely.
And it's about being open to that feedback, and having, when you have both people mm-hmm. open to that feedback, that's where that magic happens, because out of that emerges something unique that never would have occurred with just two individuals.
Oh, absolutely. And it's really difficult, and I fail many times to let go of the ego, right? To let go of the ego of, I know better. No, this is the right way. This way, one way that I do is the right way. And that's so hard to let go of. But I think, not to make it about the work again, but wood firing helps you with humility. And it helps to let go of perhaps one of the biggest albatrosses that we can have emotionally, which is expectation. If we go into something and there's only one potential outcome, any variance will throw us. But if we're open to the idea that we'll see what happens, learn and adjust from there, then it becomes a little easier.
It's interesting you said that wood firing creates humility, right? You have to have humility in order to do wood firing. I don't know which one comes first. but tell us a little bit about your work. So, lots of the audience might be in a different part of the world, or maybe only use an electric oxidation methodology. So tell us a little bit about your work. And of course, I'll put links to your website and your Instagram and all that sort of stuff on the show so people can find your work. And when I started this podcast, I thought, this is kind of odd doing an audio-only podcast about things you look at. But in a way, I want to think that creates an opportunity for people to imagine, because I think we really live in that space. Now, anyway, that's a little bit about me. But could you tell us a little bit about your work, what it looks like, what you're trying to accomplish with it, and of course, touch on the wood fire?
For sure. Let me start, because I think that I'm the guy that takes the baton first and starts running. So generally we work with smooth, low iron clay bodies, not necessarily porcelain, sometimes things like Laguna B-Mix, which is just a porcelainous stoneware that's very smooth. Sometimes we'll use, before Hurricane Helene, we used some high water clays. There's one called Loafer's Glory that had a nice response to the atmosphere in our kiln. But we're looking for something that is smooth in texture, so that whatever surface work Jess is doing doesn't get interrupted by bits of grit and grog sticking through the surface. And generally the pieces start on the wheel. We do a little bit of hand building, but primarily it's wheel thrown work. Generally, I would say medium scale, bigger. We do some functional like mugs and things, but we like to do more sort of statement pieces, larger vases and things like that. And of course, mix it up so that we can pack the kiln efficiently. A lot of times things are thrown and altered in some way, or they have some kind of detail in the rim shape or handle appendages to add some interest. And then we bisque fire the work, and then Jess takes over at that point. I guess sometimes we'll use a more iron-rich stoneware and apply a white slip before the bisque to give her a lighter background. Things tend to get dark in our reduction atmosphere in the train kiln, so we try to bring those tones toward the light end so that Jess can then add things on top that'll have some good contrast. Then you want to talk about kind of where you take it and how, what mainly like your thought process and how you come up with subject matter. And
absolutely. First, I want to say I love that you do an audio podcast about visual things, because it first gives you an opportunity to listen to someone's process and priorities without being influenced by that. It's like when you read a book, you know, and your imagination runs wild before perhaps they make it into a movie or something. And it's just, I love that, because it honors them as sort of separate things, even though they are integrated, how you approach it. So As you said, a lot of nature themes. And without oversharing, I, like a lot of people, had a little bit of a rough start, a rough childhood, and nature was always a solace. It was always a comfort, a peace, reconnecting with a part of myself and, you know, imagining a sense of freedom. And so a lot of the bird imagery, you know, it comes from that idea of spaciousness, of rewilding, of recognizing an untamed part of myself that hung on. And I am surprisingly actually a control freak. So I did start in a cone six ox. I want to put it in. I want to know what's going to happen. I want to see it come out the way that I want it to. I mean, easier said than done, but you know what I mean. and then the wood firing. And there was something so magical and unexpected about getting these gifts where you co-create with fire, with ash, with at some point where you have to let go. And I thought, well, what a beautiful metaphor. And so I fell in love with the process, although I do have a really big rule for myself, which is once we unload, I cannot look at the pieces again for 2 weeks, because I still fight the disappointment between my expectation and the result. And not looking at them for 2 weeks lets there be a reset. And then I can look at them and appreciate them for what they are, not for what I wanted them to be, and I can let go. And I don't know that anyone else struggles with that like I do, but for me, it's been very helpful. One of the things that's been important to me is this concept of time. And for each image that I like to draw or paint, I'm painting a specific bird or a specific flower blooming at that moment of time. It is its own unique portrait. It's a biography of a moment situated in a place and in a time. And I feel like that's also what the pot is. It captured who Rob was when he sat at the wheel that day. It captured his fingers moving slowly up the sides of the vase, and you can put your fingers in those ridges. When he dips it in the white slip, you see the imprints of his fingers. And then, you know, when it's my turn, my first layer is usually white to help the color stay true in the wood kiln. And I'll use my fingers to finger paint the first layer, because I still want that freedom. I want that childlike play. I want the trace of my fingers literally also on the surface. And I think that there's something special about honoring a specific bloom or specific bird and treating it with the same reverence that you would have a Renaissance portrait or something, that you're slowing down and you're noticing. And I think that for me, at least, the journey of becoming an artist has been the journey of noticing more. And that carries over when I hold other people's work. And I think most potters listening to this will find the same thing. As you experience more and as you grow more, you notice, and your notice almost narrows in a way. You notice the little details that make something special. And it's a gift. It's a gift of experience that gives you that vision. I love playing with the idea of inverting where the details are. So in the blackbird pieces, all the details are in the background. The foreground, the subject, is just a silhouette. And I don't know why that amused me, but I like that idea. And yet it still commands visual notice and without barely any details in it. I'll also write words on the pot that are messages to the future people who might choose to own it that I paint over. It might sound really silly, but they're sort of like benedictions. They're hopes for the people that might take them and welcome them into their home. And I like to make everything a ritual. I think it's my neurodivergent self, but when I start to paint, I'll pick a song. So each piece will have a soundtrack to it. It'll have a feeling because I think that every single mark you make on a pot reflects the moment of what's going on. It's that same concept of time. You know, are you joyful? Are you frustrated? You know, you put everything that you have into those marks and you can see the different energy. And they are these little biographies of a few hours in our lives, both in nature and personally. And I love that.
So good. You make a piece that's really all of you. I mean, it's really both of you, right? It's all of you. It's your heart, it's your mind, it's your fingers, it's your sore shoulders after humping clay for a while, right? It's everything, right? And so each piece, it sounds like, is really reflective of an entire process for you, of entire life in a way, that reflects who you are at that particular at this particular moment in time.
Absolutely.
There's always progression because I think Jess is always pushing forward. She says she always wants to improve something just by 1%, and I love that. You know, she's not trying to reinvent the wheel every time, but she's looking for one thing that she can improve or add, and over time, it's amazing all the things that she's figured out technically, how to get colors to stay true in the kiln. Different ways of enriching the surface with different thicknesses of line quality, and she's always just pushing forward, and also asking more of me. You know, how can you? She's always saying, you know, get back to that play state. You know, I don't want you to just make me the thing. I want you to get there and put yourself into the pieces, and we'll figure out how to make them work. And that's pretty cool to be. You know, encouraged to play. I think one thing that we should point out is that we are not super productive potters. We, you know, we have other jobs. I teach at a high school. We run this business together. I'm a musician. And Jess has got a lot of health issues that there are stretches of time where she can't work in on. Physically on the art, I think she's always looking for inspiration, and the wheels are always turning. But so I guess we're sort of appreciative of the time when we can create and try to make the most of it. It's not the put a bird on it approach to art. It's like, you know, appreciate the moment when you can create because you don't know that tomorrow you can continue to create.
You remember when you asked how it worked for us to work together? That so encouraging, so supportive, helping me see things about myself I would never see otherwise. That he lifted me up. Thank you so much. I definitely have health things that have influenced how I work. And I don't know if you want to get into that or not. We
It's up
don't
to you.
have
It's up to
to.
you. You tell your story.
We are not prolific, and part of that is intentionally. To me, the value is the time poured into it. That is a really important part of it to me. I could streamline things. I could go with, Cricut silhouettes or something, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's just for me, part of it is imbuing it intentionally with spending time with it. I have, as of yet, an undefined neurological autoimmune disease, and recently, epilepsy as well, laid on top of that. So the autoimmune disease, the first time that I realized that this was going to be a new part of my life, I was actually in Naomi Clements' mentorship program. And if you were wondering if she is as lovely as she seems to be, absolutely and probably more. Encouraging, nurturing, pulling the best out of you, fabulous. But I had my first really significant flare-up and I temporarily went blind. I lost my sight. And I was unable to really use my hands, or it was very scary. As someone who every single thing for me I delight in revolves around my vision, reading, creating. It was a really scary time. As I was recovering, I started making pinch pots. It was a way to both give physical therapy for my hands and get them used to working and work on my fine motor skills again. And it was also a way to find something that would be a step forward. I could still create, I could still do something. And so without seeing, I was still able to make these pinch pots on my couch and I set them aside after they were bisqued. And once I had my sight fully back again, I went back and did the imagery so I could sort of complete the journey with those pieces. And when I find myself challenged, I find that it's really healing, and I think it's true for other people too, to slow down and make a pinch pot, to focus on something small, to do it almost like a meditation, to revel in what it feels like, remind yourself, what does it feel like to do these very simple, basic things? And then, when you hold a pinch pot cup, it actually feels very comforting, very intimate. And you can literally trace, the movements of that journey, because I couldn't do it all at once. I would work on one pinch pot teacup for maybe 5 hours with breaks in between just because I wasn't very strong. And so I still have those periods where I can't use my hand. I can't hold a paintbrush. I can't hold a pencil, nothing. And that inspired the first movement I used to do, Mishima, into using, underglaze to paint on the surface, because I still am not able to really have the strength in my hands to do Mishima anymore. And then as there's been disease progression, I have had wonderful people come into my life. And I don't know if Christine Kasaiba's work or Kirsten Stengel, or so I on a whim took sculpture workshops with them. I had no idea. I was like, and I even tried the day of to back out. I'm like, what am I doing? I'm not a sculptor. I can't do this. I was like, just go and see what happens. And moving my hands in that way, so immediate, so responsive. Christine in particular, gave me a way forward. So even if I lose my ability to paint, there will always be something I can do that feels good. And when you think that you might not be able to do the thing that you love, being thrown a lifeline like that is absolutely amazing. And what's interesting is it also taught me, by doing sculpture, it changed my painting when I came back around to that. Working in one way influenced another. And I think that that's really interesting how just opening yourself up to creating in new ways and tapping into a sense of discovery and playfulness again, especially if you maybe have gotten to a habit in one area, really invigorates what your other ways of creating.
Wow, you've talked a lot about a lot of things there. A couple of things that I want to draw on. One is that you reached out to other people as a way for you to heal yourself and learn and build in new parts of yourself. And the other part that struck me, and I think it's because I relate to it probably, is that the clay itself, when you've got your fingers in it, is really a meditative experience. That I remember when I started on the wheel first, and my mind would go off to something else, and that meant the piece of mud on the clay on the wheel would go somewhere else too. And so therefore you had to really learn how to focus and how to which is really a meditative outcome. So I really get that's really beneficial to us as artists, to be able to get into the moment.
Oh, absolutely. That Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi getting in the flow. It does. It's this may be the only type of meditation I can reliably do. But I do think that connection with other artists, community, and as a self-proclaimed introvert who would be very happy reading a novel and sipping tea on my own all day, it was a bit of a challenge to realize that the connection is vital. The way that we learn from other people, the way that we can encourage and sustain one another, the way that we are not alone, even when we feel alone. Every relationship has been such a gift to me. And yes, it's benefited my work, but it's benefited who I am as a person more. And, you know, Naomi and Kirsten and Christine, they all are so generous. And I think that that's something that is true in the pottery community in general, perhaps that's special about it in the arts world, is that, and I totally understand when someone has worked hard and doesn't want to, you know, divulge their secrets, but these women are so open because they want to reach down and lift up. And I find that so inspiring. And they have nurtured and encouraged and supported me and helped me become a better human. And I love them dearly and admire their work.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I don't want to take us away too much from this really delightful conversation, but I would like to ask you just a little bit about the technique that you use for some of your color and surface design, given that that's the name of this podcast. I guess we should touch on that a little bit. Do you use underglazes, slips, oxides? Like, what's your approach to the surface?
Absolutely. Well, Rob will do the first layer in a white slip, intentionally leaving those fingerprint marks. That's very important to me. And then I will go in and I will first sketch, ideally from life in my garden or my neighbor's gardens. Sorry, neighbors. Thank you. and I will just do a quick sketch in the pencil. And then, you, I don't know if you, do you guys have press and seal in Canada? Oh, I'm sorry. I will cover my design in the press and seal on the side that's in my lap so it doesn't smear. I do a first base layer in the Amoco Velvet underglaze in bright white. And I found that that helps the colors on top that I apply stay true. And I mix my underglaze colors, not from scratch, but from the Amoco Velvet from primaries, because I find that at the high temperatures, they hold the most true. So medium blue, radiant red, and intense yellow, along with the bright white and the jet black. So everything is from those colors. I don't dilute with water. I use glycerin. I find that it gives me a better result and higher workability on the bisque. And then I keep in little canning jars. I will make up a palette for a particular type of flower. So I always have my, you know, hellebore purple or whatever. And that's very, very helpful. Or if I'm working on a vase, I'll put it in a wet palette. And then again, with the press and seal over it, and that'll keep for a while. And I can rehydrate it with a little glycerin, again, instead of water, if that's something I want. And then once I do that, I have become a huge convert of the air pen.
No, do you know tell the air me about pen? The air pen.
So the air pen was originally made for creating designs on silk scarves, but you can fill the chambers. It's a vacuum air driven device. I don't know exactly how to describe it.
Sounds like it has a little bit of a compressor on it or something. And it drives the material through a needle.
Yep, without getting the burps. And you just fill the chamber with whatever you'd like. And then I usually use a 25 gauge needle for the interior details and a 22 gauge needle for the larger details. And you can just draw on that and with that. And I love how it makes it feel like an old botanical illustration to be able to work that way. And I just do I'll start with the very thin layers of the mixed underglazes thinned with the glycerin and build them up almost like you would if you were oil painting. So nothing is an opaque layer. Everything is something that shows the layer underneath. I like it feeling, you know, archaeological, where you see all the strata and you can see them peeking through. And then I'll go back and I'll outline with the air pen. And I love that tool, especially if there's anyone out there that has any arthritis or hand issues. it's a lot easier to underglaze trail with this device than it is to have to squeeze the bottle over and over. I love it. I've seen some people do interesting things with it, like slip trailing as well. Again, since it's a
Yeah.
vacuum, you know,
That's very
that's
interesting. I have to
interesting.
put a link in our show notes about that. Thanks very much. That's great. Love to hear a little bit of a tip about how to do something instead of getting cramps from the bulb, right,
Oh
to
my gosh.
use something else. Hey, but let's jump back to community, because I think that that's a key piece of what you guys are all about. I went onto your website and was looking at the values that you outline and how important a number of things are in your teaching component, although I think that it's all part of who you are. Can you talk a little bit about community and how you link your values to the community and what that's done for you and the people in it?
Absolutely. And since I've sucked all the air out of the room, Rob, do you want to say something?
Well, so I experienced that firsthand. I was kind of at a transition point in life. I had just finished a degree in molecular ecology that I didn't end up using for anything other than fun. And just on a lark, took a pottery class at the studio that we now own, and immediately felt at home and felt all these kindred spirits around creating. I found myself wanting to pitch in and help out. Before I had been there very long, I found myself on the roof fixing leaks in the roof. I was willing to do whatever to make that place run and continue to be. And so, after a year of trying to teach high school at a boarding school that lasted exactly 1 year, I came back to Athens and started working in that studio again, and ended up with the opportunity to buy the business from the woman who started it. And that was kind of my, oh gosh, I guess I'm a ceramic artist now,
And a business
and a
owner, I was
business
going
owner.
to add.
None of the things that I was
Yeah.
trained to do. I kind of saw myself as a university professor running a lab. But
Well, you kind of do now.
life is what it
You kind
is.
of run a lab,
Yeah,
right?
well,
And you
I
are
do run
kind
a
of
lab, and
university
a zoo at the same
professor-like.
time. No. No, it's so wonderful. And from the moment I took it over, I was on the receiving end of people who were like me that just wanted to see the place thrive and succeed. And we were in downtown Athens in a old seed warehouse, this great huge building with high ceilings. Sounds romantic until you realize it's also not air conditioned and a summer in a brick warehouse. So about 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, we moved the business, and that was right around the time I met Jess, and she jumped in and physically helped move all of our business to the new location and get the new space ready. And crazy how much effort we both put in really to get the new space set up. And from the time we opened over there, we've just tried to continue this welcoming atmosphere. It doesn't matter who you are, what your background is, come in, create, find common ground with everyone there, and understand that we all need the same things. We need people to love us. We need people to accept us for who we are. We need an outlet for our creative impulses. And we need the sort of attaboys and attagirls from the people around us say, hey, you're doing great. You might be a very beginner potter and your thing might not be perfectly symmetrical, but we've all been there, and your efforts are valuable. And so I don't know, for me, I feel awfully lucky that that's where I go to work every day. There's lots of aspects that no one wants when you're running a business, but the day-to-day, just getting to be there amongst people who want to be there and want to be together and want to support each other is pretty great. And the fact that it supports us is also something that I'm really grateful for. We have enough people wanting to be part of that we don't have to worry about whether our classes are going to fill. And that's a pretty wonderful place to be in. We're not having to constantly shake around and advertise, and it's at this point, I've owned it since 04, and the business started in 97. So it is enough of a sort of cornerstone of the community that people find us. And when once they find us, they want to stay.
I mean, you know, at this point, you know, I talk too much and I overshare. So I absolutely want to chime in. When I first went to a class at Good Dirt, I was in, and we don't have to go down this rabbit hole, but I was in an abusive marriage. And being able to find Clay was finding myself again. And I can say with confidence, it literally saved my life. It is a type of therapy, 100%. And because I received the gift of that healing myself, I realized how important it was to make that accessible to other people. And, you know, as we get older, it's hard to make friends, and you can end up isolated without ever meaning to. And when you can be in a space, even if you're not necessarily talking to people, but being in a space of creative energy and working side by side, that's special. And I think that what we have created at Good Dirt is the thing I am most proud of in my life, that community. You see people who are, you know, freshmen in college working alongside people who are in their 80s. And we don't have that kind, at least in America, I don't see that often, that generational connection where we're working, respecting people of all different, you know, ages. We also, I think, by trying to make sure it's accessible, meaning we haven't changed our prices in over a decade. Part of our mission statement is to not do that, to keep it affordable. And then if you can afford it, anyone can get a scholarship. And furthermore, if you need a scholarship, you don't have to justify it. You don't have to prove it, because it's probably already a trauma for you that you needed to ask, and we don't need to double down. We don't check up on you. You can do it for as long as you like. If you have $5 at the end of the month, great. If you don't, fine. But you don't have to prove it to us. You can just come here and heal and be. And I think also we trust, we're very, very open. So, you know, yeah, Rob's laughing. So if someone, you know, is like, oh, I've got the money for class, where should I put it? Just put it on the desk in the office. We leave everything open, we leave everything out. And I find that when you trust people, they live up to it. And if for some reason that money went missing, I guarantee they needed it and find and a story. That's the best way it could have been spent. And we also try to do things as a community for our community at large. So when the Hurricane Helene hit, for instance, we did a donation sale. And all that meant is that everyone in the studio gave work that they had made that other people in the community at large could come and buy, and the donations would go 100% to the hurricane victims. But then word got out, and other potters in Roswell and Alpharetta wanted to join us, and other artists in Athens wanted to join us. And so we were able to give with what we made. We were able to connect to other people for a common cause. And I think that that also brings folks together. We also try to stay really accessible. So all 250 of our students have our personal cell numbers, and they're encouraged if they're having a hard time, if they're struggling, because who hasn't had a hard time? Who hasn't struggled? Who hasn't gotten that moment where you're looking at something on the wheel and it feels overwhelming, and that big F word of failure starts creeping in your head and you need some help? They can text us immediately. They can call us. We can help. We can be there. And I think just by putting that out into the world, you get that back. And so we have this fabulous, wonderful community that is honestly chock full of a lot of vulnerable people who maybe felt like they weren't wanted or didn't fit in other places. And we have said, you're exactly who we want. Please come and be here. And the sign on our front door says, everyone is welcome here. You are wanted and welcome here. And we really stand by that, or at least try to. We strive to be a safe place for people.
Yeah, I think it's really clear as I listen to you that you guys really live your values. And I think often, I don't know about where you live, but I often think that we've lost sight of that in our world.
I think that's the thing that, I don't know if it will surprise people, but the more you try to do for others, the bigger the gift is to yourself. Because you find a connection and you find a place where you belong. And I think, I mean, not to sound like that person in today's world of digital, blah, 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 but I think that we are sort of pulling apart. And any time that we can come together is something that should be treasured and encouraged. And, you know, I know you know everything that's going on in America right now. And so looking and trying to heal and trying to fill the gaps and the needs in our community for the people who have been abandoned by this administration and try to present a different way of living and interacting, I think is very important. And it is a gift.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think in lots of ways, my experience with the world these days, not just the challenges the your administration is putting on everybody, but is that we've become isolated. We've kind of moved into this tribalism, and that I'm in my tribe and I'm not in your tribe, and you guys are bad and we're good, and those kind of thinking and living notions. And so the idea of being able to come together and accept each other for what you are and allow people to live their lives and be successful is really a really cool idea. I think that's where we need to be. And we can still, I think, have our own politics and our own beliefs, but often we don't listen to each other anymore. I was reflecting on back in the day when I was at university, we would have great debates about things. We would debate about art or about politics or about darn near anything. And I really enjoyed those. These days, it seems like we don't have those kind of debates anymore, where I actually listen to what you have to say, and you listen to what I have to say, and then we debate that. But we are respecting each other's point of view while we're having the debate. And I think that's what I hear you guys trying to create. Not trying. You guys are creating in your space.
Thank you for that. I think a lot of times behind views we might not agree with is fear or anger or lack of exposure. And so, you know, joy, art, community, these are all acts of resistance. These are all ways to be exposed to people, things, ideas that we wouldn't normally. And it's a way to remake the world one small community at a time. And I think it's a really powerful idea.
Yeah, it's very cool. One of the goals I had for this podcast was to create some sort of community with it. And I'm not sure I've been successful with that. I'm not sure how to do that, but maybe you could noodle on that a little bit and think about that and give me some thoughts later. But having folks like you on the podcast where we talk about these kinds of ideas, in addition to, you know, how did I make that color stick to the pot and not fall off, is really, really important, probably more important than knowing about the technical piece.
Well, I think that's so showing the sharing technique is a form of community. It's giving up yourself.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah.
It's all good.
It's all part of the process. Yeah, for sure. Hey, I want to thank you guys for being here today with our community. I really think everybody will just love your conversation and learn from you some of the technique-y things, learn about your pen, but also learn at a really much deeper level about how to have a successful life, even through diversity, not through adversity. And that's really important. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us. And I almost knee-jerk said, love you, Bob. Bye. But I do. It's true. Yeah. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.